Well, a gentleman on the end is a senior member amongst us here, Mr. Paul Johns. It's a pleasure to have you here. Paul is 96, soon to be 97 years old. I think he's doing fantastic myself. And this gentleman has quite a history. He learned to fly, I believe, in 1928. And Paul, you then went on to work for Pan American Airlines. You flew DC-3s for Pan Am for a long time. And you went on to fly the Boeing Clippers, the 314, I believe. And so you have quite a career. Then went on to fly corporate airplanes, corporate DC-3s. Want to tell us just a little bit about how old you were when you learned how to fly, where you were, and so forth?
Ryan, you'll have to get a little closer to me.
Too many big engines.
I can't understand you.
Okay.
I can't. You'll have to get close to me here.
Okay, let me get close to you where you can read my lips a little bit, huh? How about telling us where you learned how to fly and when that was, and what you learned to fly in?
1929 is when I first learned solid. It was in a glider, and we kept the wings level for a little while, and this gentleman put 200 feet of rope on the glider, put a Model A Ford on the end of the rope, pulled me up to 200 feet, and we landed. That was my first solo. I was 15 years old. And
good for you. I'd say that's pretty fantastic. And then you went on to fly what kind of an airplane? What was the first airplane you were in?
The next airplane we got into was the Curtiss Wright Jr. with the Zeekly three-cylinder engine on it. I soloed that in 45 minutes. And I used that little airplane, got my private license in 1931, 1932 my commercial license, and 2 years later I got the transport license.
Yeah. That's great. I'd say that's pretty fantastic. Okay, when did you first go to work for Pan American?
I went to work with Pan American in the late 1939, early 1940. We actually went to work for Pan Am I was hired to set up a training division for them first. And we did that. That was before Pearl Harbor. We ran that for a year or so, then Pearl Harbor came along, and the military took over the training division then. And I went on to the airline training division after that, and I put 2 years in as check pilot in the training division there. By that time, Pan Am had retired the flying boats on the South American runs and made landing strips on all the stops and started using DC-3s on them at that time. So when I went onto the line, we went directly on DC-3s.
I see. And I know you were talking to me a little bit about going into Rio de Janeiro.
Oh, yes.
Tell them just a little bit about the approach in there and how you handle that.
Well, there was no air control over the airways at that time. Going into Rio de Janeiro, our initial altitude there was 10,000 feet. And of course, the only landing systems we had then, we didn't have ILS or VOR or anything like that. It's strictly by loop. You couldn't come into the harbor on Rio de Janeiro because they had big Sugarloaf mountains in the harbor that went up to a couple thousand feet. So you had to get into the landing strip some other way. And that was down at sea level. Actually, the landing strip was out into the bay area there, and is built back there. And we had a Homer, a radio Homer, on that landing strip. And we had another one out into the mountains. And we shuttled back and forth with the loop bearings to make our approaches there. Actually, we'd home in on the locator out in the mountains, and we do a square pattern to establish our wind drift. We call that the system a QDM system. It kept taking bearings till we could establish our wind drift. Then we honed in from there and descended towards a strip down at the sea level.
I see. I see. That sounds like an interesting approach.
It was. Luckily, I wasn't on that one too long. I had a few approaches there, but we taught it all the time in the training division too.
Did they ever lose any airplanes going in there at your
No, they were pretty good. The guys are pretty sharp at it.
I bet they were. They had to be, didn't they? Absolutely.
Because every place we went, there, of course, in South America then, was all a loop navigation. That's strictly that. So they got a lot of training to the pilots.
I'll bet they did. Now, I think you were telling me that when you fly across the equator down there, something happens, doesn't it? Didn't you tell me something?
What's that?
When you fly across the equator, didn't you tell me something happened then?
Well, we had a little thing we used to do as we went across the equator. The equator goes right across the mouth of the Amazon River there. And usually when we went across the equator, we'd hump the airplane a little bit like that. Well, one trip I didn't know it, but the steward had served a cup of coffee to a passenger that's way back in the tail end of the airplane. Well, that cup of coffee went up like that, right on down like the over guy. When we got home that trip, why, there was a notice came out, no humping the equator from there.
Thanks, Paul. That's great. That's good, Paul. When we were talking backstage, I know that I'm certainly no expert on flying a DC-3, but I got several hours in it. But I have always had a lot of difficulty and don't even try very often to stall land the airplane. And in talking with these guys, particularly Deke and Jim, that's all they did back in World War II. Is that correct, Deke?
Well, a lot of the stuff we hauled up the front lines, we'd land in these, just really a cow pasture. And there wasn't that much room. And when I got into the outfits, the pilots that were flying them were really sharp. And they bring that C-47 in and three-point it. And I don't, unless we had hard surface, it was just always three-point landings.
Yeah, did you experience the same thing, Jim? Is that what you did most of the time, three-point landings?
Well, our commanding officer had been in Burma. And when he formed the organization and we were in training, he marked off 1,800 feet of the runway and said, don't use any more of it. And it took us a while to get there, but eventually we could. And when we got over into the New Guinea and the Philippines, we were very glad he'd done that.
Bernie, how about you? Did you encounter the same thing, mostly three-point landings, or did you do wheel landings?
No, I landed power off consistently and tried to hit it on the end of the runway. The runways were frequently quite short. I never had to go in anything as short as 1,800 feet, but I've been into 2,500 feet and usually didn't take much more than half of it.
Gary, how about you?
We had like 10,000 feet there at Da Nang. It was hard and didn't seem much of a reason.
I remember that. I sure do.
Didn't seem much of a reason to make a full stall landing. Yeah. We wheel landed all the time.
I remember when I first went over to Vietnam, I was based in Da Nang also. And, of course, the Caribou is a short-field airplane. And I initially went over in 1966 and flew with an Army company for about a month. And they had a whole different perspective on life than the Air Force as far as flying was concerned. So the Air Force controllers at Da Nang expected us to land on the overrun and turn off at the end of the runway. So and if we didn't do that, they'd get highly upset. So.
Like some of those faster movers had parachutes. They
absolutely
wanted you out of the
absolutely
way. They wanted me
they
out of
sure
the way,
did
too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Deke, can you recall one of your most memorable moments on the C-47? Anything you can think of off the top of your head that really stands out?
Well, no. One thing I do remember about the DC-3, I went with Capital Airlines in 1950, and the flying co-pilot on the DC-3s, right behind my seat there were two pockets. The first one was a putty knife, and when you get ice on the windshield, you open up this little glare, this little window on the side, reach out and scrape the ice off. And the other one was a pocket that had a rain apron on it. And when it was raining, you'd put that over your lap because the airplane just leaked like crazy. And
still that way today. Hadn't changed a bit. Jim, you think of any real memorable moments or experiences you had on the C-47?
Well, I guess the most memorable thing is hearing the bullets go through the back end of the airplane from the Japs that were shooting at us.
I can relate to that. Gary?
Yeah, I remember Christmas time, 1972. At Christmas, I got picked to go on a goodie trip over to Hong Kong. We were supporting a couple orphanages there in Da Nang, and we went to Hong Kong, of course, to buy cheap toys to bring back. So I was a co-pilot at the time and designated to base ops. Asked me to have the aircraft in front of base ops at 0400. And I had never solo taxied a DC-3 in my life, which was 22 years old at that time, long, long life. So I asked an instructor pilot friend of mine, I said, can I do that? And he asked me, can you do that? And I said, I can do that. He said, you can do that. So I fired up the engines, and the hardest part of flying a DC-3 is getting it to the end of the runway. So I feel I did pretty good, got it over to base ops. Then I was summarily dismissed to the back of the aircraft for the entire flight to Hong Kong. And then at Hong Kong, the same thing happened. The crew disappeared to arrange for lodging, and we were at the fuel pit, and the refueling crew wanted me to move the airplane. They needed to refuel other aircraft. So I'm well experienced now solo taxiing the DC-3, so I'm ready to go. So I taxied out and got it running, had a crew chief with me, and he wanted to put the control locks on, and I didn't want to be taxiing around at Hong Kong International Airport with the control locks on. That looked like, you know, we forgot to pull the pins or something, so I told him, no, we didn't want the control locks on. But the first intersection, the tower asked me to make a starboard turn, and, I mean, how many of you 22-year-olds out there know the difference between a port and starboard turn at that point? So I was a little confused at that. So I asked him, Roger, you want me to make a right turn at the next intersection? And he confirmed right turn. But there was a good crosswind blowing that day, and I had trouble getting the tailwheel unlocked. I'd either forgotten to unlock it soon enough, and I had a load on it, and it would not turn to starboard or to port. We didn't want to go either way. So I had huge power on the left engine trying to get it going, holding a brake, and it wouldn't turn. I had a 747 right behind me. Pan Am 747, and they asked him if he wanted, he told the tower, oh, we'll wait for the Goonie Bird, not a problem. So now I've got this great big guy behind me, can't get the tailwheel unlocked. So finally made a slight left turn and got the pressure off the pin that locks that tailwheel, and boy, it turned really, really nicely after that. So
especially with the wind.
Absolutely. So I got the airplane back out of the fuel ramp there, and worked out pretty good. So
that's great. Bernie, any real memorable moments you can recall?
Not really. I don't have any good stories like that.
Okay. Okay. Paul, I'm going to come down and talk to you again, okay?
Yeah, okay.
I know you told me back there you had a couple of memorable experiences when you were flying the DC-3 in the corporate world, didn't you?
Yeah, a couple.
Want to tell us about one of them?
Well, yes. I'd left the airlines and went corporate flying. And this particular trip, I had the president of the company on board and a couple of vice presidents. And we were going into Brownsville, Texas, where we were shooting for. But we had a big front between Jackson, Mississippi, and Brownsville. And so I was going to stop at Jackson, Mississippi, and put on more fuel because I wanted enough fuel on board. Well, I'm pulling out of Jackson, and on the climb out, the whole cockpit filled with smoke. It was so thick I had to open a window to breathe. All the power went off. I had a little pen light here. I had to use the see the instrument panel to fly by. Uh-huh. Oh, a little instrument panel, a little pen light to see the instrument panel, and my co-pilot called. They had just enough power to get back to the control tower and tell them we had smoke in the cockpit. So we came back, got in, landed, no lights or anything else.
That sounds interesting.
We made it. We made it, though.
Good for you. We're glad that you did. We're glad that you did. Well, let's give these gentlemen a hand. I'll tell you, I think they've done a fantastic job and recognize their service, particularly the World War II, the Vietnam veterans. We're proud of all of you. Thank you very much. That's it. I helped you down.